Welcome, everybody. Great to be with you all and to worship together. If you want to follow along in your Bibles, we'll be in Colossians chapter 3 in just a few moments. All of the texts will be on the screen as well, so you can follow along on the screen. But Colossians 3 is where we'll begin. Before we do that, though, I just want to take a minute or two to express my gratitude to you all. It has been such a joy to be here for the last few days and to spend time with you all and get to know you. I mentioned that this is not my first trip here and that the time I'd been here before had really made an impression. And this trip has done a very similar thing. And I'll think about this and think about the time with you all for a long time. We've been talking about a lot of barriers that we face as Christians. And one of the things that I'm grateful for about this weekend is just how open you all have been about the ways that these lessons have helped you and encouraged you, and just even some of the barriers and the struggles that you're dealing with right now. And I think that's part of, by God's design, how we get through this. He gives us a family, He puts us in a body, and we help each other. We strengthen each other. We bear those burdens that we talked about. So thank you for your openness to welcoming me into the family here. And thank you to Mo and Janet. I would be sorely remiss if I didn't express my gratitude to them. They have treated me like family, and they've just let me kind of be in their house like I would be at my house, and that's asking a lot. It's not easy to have people into your home, but they are amazingly gracious hosts, and I've loved the time with them, and I know you all love them dearly. So thank you to Mo and Janet especially. So barriers, we talked this morning about fear and how that can get in the way of us being the kinds of people that God wants us to be and sharing our faith. We talked before communion about the barrier of sin, the greatest barrier that there is, the constant threat to us, and how Jesus helps us overcome that barrier. I'm going to close our time in these sessions by talking about what is also a barrier of great threat. And the threat is just because of how constant and how much this is around us. It's a part of our reality, and that is worldliness. We are children of light in a dark world, but we have to participate in that world. And it's kind of like, you know, being a fish in water. You can't really go anywhere and escape it. And I think that at least in this physical existence, that's how the world is for us. We are to be salt and light. We're to be in the world, but not of the world. And that can be a challenging thing. So we're gonna look at some text in Scripture that hopefully will help us and equip us to see how we deal with that, the constant worldliness around us, and why it's so important that we take this seriously. I don't know that there is anything as a Christian that is more important than what we think about. And you can probably expand that and say it doesn't matter if you're a Christian or not. For all humans, what we think about really determines where we go in life. The things that we meditate on, the things that we focus on, are the things that point us in a certain direction. And so Paul expresses the importance in our thinking of setting our minds not on earthly things but on things that are above. So we'll start with this text in Colossians chapter 3. And read with me, beginning in verse 1, how Paul says this. Colossians 3, verse 1 says, "Therefore, if you have been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with Him in glory." So before we, as we get into this, this text offers an initial challenge because it shows us that there are a couple of barriers or a couple of obstacles to setting our minds on things above. One of the things that this text implies is that there are other things that we can set our mind on constantly. We don't have to set our minds on things above. We can choose to set them on whatever we want to. You just think about just this morning on your drive here to the church building. How many things was your mind set on? You know, maybe you were thinking about conversations you were having with your kids. that started at the house and were like continuing on the drive here. Maybe you had music going that you were listening to and thinking about and singing along with. Maybe you're watching out for like for road signs, construction, turn directions. You know, some of you that are visiting maybe haven't been here before, and so you're making sure that you know where you're going. Watching out for other drivers. The roads here in New England are crazy. Everything's narrow and windy. And I live in Indiana in a part of the state that's just completely flat. It's farmland. So we don't have those challenges there. But, you know, just to illustrate that, maybe you see a billboard on the sign or you think about, hey, there's a restaurant we might go to for lunch or for dinner. There are so many things that we can set our minds on. Many of which, maybe most of which, are not things that are above. The other challenge that I think is kind of brought out in this text, or at least implied, is that it's possible that we don't actually have to set our minds on anything. I mean, we live in a world that is so good at grabbing our attention that we don't have to deliberately choose what we think about. We can just kind of go along, and the world is really good at kind of telling us what to set our minds on and grabbing our attention and pulling our focus in this direction or that direction. So this is it becomes a really challenging text really fast. I want to share with you a version of this. It's from a paraphrase. It's called The Message. Some of you may be familiar with it. And I want to emphasize this is a paraphrase of the Bible. I'm not recommending this for its biblical accuracy. It is what it is. It's a paraphrase. But as I was reading these verses in different versions, I came across this, and I think that it paints a very helpful picture and a challenging picture of what we're being called to do. And here's how The Message paraphrases verse 2. Don't shuffle along, eyes to the ground, absorbed with the things right in front of you. Look up and be alert to what is going on around Christ. That's where the action is. See things from His perspective. Do you ever met somebody like this or seen somebody who's kind of doing this? They're just shuffling along, you know, kind of scuffing their feet, eyes to the ground. What inevitably happens when somebody, like, that's the way that they go through life? You know, if there's something up in front of them, they're not going to see it till the last minute. They're going to be running into stuff all the time. But even if they avoid obstacles, they're never going to go anywhere, you know? Like, if you just have your face set to the ground all the time and just shuffle along, it's not going to be conducive to progressing and going in any particular direction. Now, there are some reasons that Paul gives for why he tells us this, gives us this charge in this text. We'll come back to those in just a moment. But just think about how important it is to set our minds in the direction we want to go. Any of you take driver's ed when you were in like high school, when you were younger? I think I was in ninth grade. And one of the things, if you ever take driver's ed, that they teach you, or at least they taught us at the time, is they taught us how to look ahead, but to do it in layers. So they would teach you to look ahead of you on the road like 2 to 3 seconds ahead. And then they would also teach you to scan farther out, like maybe 10 to 15 seconds, so you could anticipate things that were coming along. And so we learned that really early on, you know, and as we're learning to drive, we learn how to set our mind or our eyes on the direction that we want to go. But what happens? We get a few years and a few miles under our belts, and, you know, we start to think we're pretty good at driving. And so instead of doing what they teach us with the hands like 10 and 2, we kind of raise it up to high noon, and we're driving with one hand, and we're using our other hand to, you know, hit the kids next to us or try to get people to calm down in the back seat, or we're like reaching back for something in the back of the car, and before you know it, we're all over the road. We're hitting the rumble strips and veering to keep from going into oncoming traffic. But that concept is there, that wherever we fix our eyes and our attention, that's where we're going to end up. Now, I talked about this paraphrase, you know, don't stumble along, eyes to the ground. Have you ever known somebody like that, that was true of spiritually? What I mean is that when it comes to thoughts about heaven or about God or like the direction of their lives, they're just not really thinking about that or aware of it much. They're just focused on whatever is right in front of them in the moment in their lives. That gets all of their bandwidth and all of their attention and all of their energy. And so
that's what they're focusing. And as a result of that, if you watch their lives over any length of time, they just are kind of shuffling along, going from one day to another, never really getting anywhere, though. And only really occupied with the things of this world. And it's so easy for us to fall into that perspective and that way of thinking. Just trying to get through the daily grind, make sure we get enough to put food on the table, pay the bills, get the kids where they need to go, all that stuff. And so this is a call to set our mind and to raise our eyes to something higher. Now, I mentioned that Paul gives us a reason for this in the text. Notice verse 3. Verse 3 is the motivation or the reason that we're called to set our mind on things above, not on things that are on the earth. What Paul says here is the reason that we do that is we have died. For you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When you think about that motivation, you ever think about, try to picture what a dead person thinks about? I know it sounds weird and probably it's impossible or whatever, but I don't know, just imagine the perspective of a dead person. Like, here's what I mean. If I were to reach into my pocket and pull out a stack of $100 bills, Benjamin Franklin's right here, could I get your attention? I, like, walked up and down the aisles and, you know, kind of held it out, let you see it, smell it. I don't care how tired you are this morning, I would have your attention. You'd be all ears. You know what I've never been able to do, though? And you know what you couldn't do? Is you couldn't take that same stack of $100 bills to a funeral and walk up to the casket and wave it in front of the deceased and be like, hey buddy, this is yours. All you got to do is just get up out of the casket. You couldn't tempt him with like a new car that you bought and you drove to the funeral home and you took the keys out and set them in the casket. And I don't mean to be disrespectful in this. I'm just thinking about, here's the point of this. You can't tempt a dead person with those things. Because they can't do anything with money. They can't drive a car. They're in a place where that stuff does nothing for them. It's meaningless. And I think that's what Paul's trying to tell us to do is we've died to all of this. So we got to set our mind on something different. We can't let those things appeal to us. Now, of course, the challenge is that even though we've died and our life is hidden with Christ, the Bible talks about how the dead person, you know, wants to come back to life. We have to crucify daily. And so that's part of the challenge, is that we have to make sure that the dead person stays dead. But here's how we do it. We do it by remembering that we're dead, and so we set our mind on the things that a dead person would think about. Not things of this earth, but the things that are after that. I'm going to take you to the text that we read, that Taylor read for us just a few moments ago, in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians 10 verses 3 through 6 give us a picture of what this looks like and how it plays out. Paul tells us, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not of the flesh, but divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. For we are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God. And we are taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And we are ready to punish all disobedience whenever your obedience is complete." What Paul describes here is a battle for the mind. And really, I think the battle for our souls is that sort of battle. It is first and foremost a battle for the mind. It's described by Paul as a battle in which thoughts and speculations and ideas, you notice how he pictures them here, they're represented as strongholds or fortresses. And what he says is the things that God has given us, the ideas that he's given us, and these aren't physical weapons, it's not guns and tanks and missiles and stuff like that, but he gives us weapons that are strong enough, no matter how strong the fortress or the idea or the philosophy or the worldview is, the things that God gives us, the weapons that he gives us, the truth that he gives us, is strong enough to knock it all down. And so we're told to take every thought captive. Now, here's what I think of when I read this text. This text reminds me of warfare. And I don't mean like modern warfare. I mean like ancient medieval warfare. You know, the kind of war that would take place when you had a city that you were trying to lay siege to that had a wall around it.
And in warfare like that, you know, they'd have all of these war machines. And, you know, whenever I think about this, I think if I had a job in one of those medieval armies, the one thing I think would be really cool, and probably wasn't at all, but it sounds cool to me, would be like to be the guy to drive the war machines, like the battering rams or the catapults or the trebuchets. And what seems really cool to me about that is you can come up to this city that is built specifically to keep people out, people like you. It's built with walls that are high and thick to make sure that if you don't belong in that city, you're not getting into it. How cool would it be to walk up to or roll up to, march up to a city like that, and with the power of a push of a button or a lever, you can knock it all down. And you can say, I don't care if you want me in your city or not, I'm coming in. And that's kind of what I think about in this text. But I want to paint a picture for you. Imagine that you're one of those soldiers and you're in charge of the battering ram, and you're coming up to the gate, the wall of the city. And you get up there, and as you're getting positioned, you look at the wall of the city, and you notice that there's a defect in it. Like there's a huge chunk of the wall that's missing. A good soldier is probably going to move the battering ram to that particular point so they can impact the weak point of the wall. But let's say that you see that, and all of a sudden you leave your post and you stop what you're doing, and you go over there and you start to patch the wall. You're going to fix it up and make it strong and fix what's wrong. Or let's say that you break into the city, and as you go in, you start to see all of these citizens who are scared and running away, and they're hiding and cowering in fear. And instead of doing what most soldiers in a situation like that would do and taking them captive or fighting against them, you start to notice in their distress, like all the grief that they're going through and the tears, and you feel compassion for them. And so you go up to them and you sit down with them and start to talk with them. And pretty soon you decide, you know what, I don't want to be a part of this whole war thing. I'm just going to hang out here with these guys and, you know, live the life that they're living and go through that. How good of a soldier would that person be? You know, how effective in battle? Not very. But I think here's one of the challenges in 2 Corinthians 10. When we set our mind on things of this world, that's exactly what we're doing. We're taking these strongholds and these fortresses that God is powerful enough to overcome, ideas that only lead to the ruin of the hearers, and we're reinforcing them. And we're connecting with them, and we're listening to them, and we're embracing them. And so that's kind of the absurdity of this text. When we set our minds on things of this earth, we're taking part in the fortresses that God designed weapons to tear down. And instead, we're building them up and finding a refuge there. You know, when you think about all of the problems in the world, I may be overstating this, but I don't think so. Do you think it's fair to say that all of the sin and all of the wrongdoing and wickedness that's ever been committed ultimately comes down to a failure to set our mind on things above? And instead a setting of the mind on things of this earth? Think about this. Genesis chapter 3, let's go back to the garden. Verse 6, when Satan lays the trap and he gets Eve to think about this temptation, notice how he does it. Verse 6 says, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. In that moment, when Eve was faced with the first conflict, first temptation, she had two choices. Set her mind on things above that God had told her, or set her mind on things of this earth. And what Satan did, and what he's really good at doing, is taking those things of the earth and holding them right in front of us. Saying, look at how good this is. Doesn't that look satisfying? Don't you think that would fill your need? Don't you think that would give you everything that you feel like you're missing, that God's holding back from you? It's right there. And so I really think that at the root of all of our sins is on some level a failure to set our mind on the heavenly thing, the heavenly choice. So this is a difficult thing.
But I want to try to talk about this not just in conceptual terms, but in practical terms. How do we actually learn to do that? What is that? What does it look like? It's one thing to say, yeah, set my mind on things above. But when we live in the reality of things below and we're surrounded by the world, how do we learn to turn our gaze elsewhere? I want to take you to a text in Deuteronomy chapter 6 where Moses gives us some things that I think help answer this question. Deuteronomy 6, we're going to read verses 5 through 9. And I want you, as we're considering Moses' answer here in a moment, just think for a little bit about the context of this. Deuteronomy is Moses' farewell address. The nation has finally come through 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. They're on the cusp of going into the land of Canaan. Moses knows he's not going to go with them. God's not going to allow him to go into the land. So what he's doing is he's preparing the nation who's going to go in and conquer the land. Think about Moses' perspective for a minute. This is spoken to him after seeing an entire generation die in the wilderness. You think that maybe some of those people that died in the wilderness were people that Moses had history with? Obviously, Miriam and Aaron. You know, he grew up with them. But maybe before Moses went into Pharaoh's house, or before when he would come and visit his people, you think there were some in the Israelite congregation that Moses had relationships with, that he knew well, and he had to watch them die. Why? Because of a failure to set their minds on things above. And what happened in the wilderness so tragically is that all they could think about in the middle of this desert was all the stuff that they had back in Egypt. All the food that God wasn't giving them in that moment. And just all the things around them that were so hard, that was making life difficult from day to day. They set their mind on things of the earth, and because of that, this entire generation was lost over 40 years in the wilderness. And so Moses, is, with that knowledge, he's trying to prepare this new generation who's going to come into a land that was flowing with milk and honey. Remember what God told them? He said, you're going to come into this land, you're going to walk into cities, and you're going to live in houses that you didn't have to build. You'll get gardens and vineyards that you didn't have to plant. You're going to have riches that you didn't accumulate for yourself. God was going to give them everything. And those two contrasts, I think, are helpful for us because they describe the challenges that we face in each of those situations. You ever been in a place in your life, a wilderness, where you were wondering where food was going to come from and how you were going to pay the bills, and everything just looked around you like a barren wasteland? And it's so easy when we're at the bottom like that to feel like in order to survive, we have to just tune everything else out except the things of this world. Making sure we get enough money, making sure we're scraping by, all that sort of stuff. But then, have you ever been in the opposite situation where the tables turn and you go from being in the wilderness to being in the promised land? And all of a sudden, you've got enough money, you've got plenty of food on the table, everybody's got enough to be happy, you've got all the toys and things that you want. Life is good. It's fun. What's striking is that how in such an opposite situation, you would think that it'd be easier for us to set our mind on things above, and yet it's just as hard. Because now we've got all the stuff that we thought about when we didn't have it. And so those things just as easily can occupy our time. So Moses is going to give advice to a generation to prepare them to set their mind on things above. How can we do that? Here's what he says. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I'm commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. There's some fascinating things about this text. This is a timeless text. What I want to draw your attention to here are the action words, the verbs that Moses instructs the Israelites to follow. He tells them to teach, to talk about, to bind, to write all of the commandments that God was giving them that day. You ever thought about why those things what's remarkable is that these four commands that Moses gives, they engage four of the five senses. Teaching, speaking, using our mouths, talking about, and that's obviously speaking, but also listening. As we teach and as we talk with people, we're speaking and we're listening. We're engaging our mouth and our ears. Bind them. In other words, he wanted them to put them in a place where they were visible. They could see the words of God. They could see heavenly things with their eyes. And then write them. Use their hands to write down things that would set their affections and their attentions on the Lord and on things above. So, speech, hearing, sight, touch, those are the things that God, that Moses tells them to do. What is God really after here? I think in some sense what God is doing here is this is God's advertising plan. Any of you folks in marketing, like is a career, you market or you do advertising or whatever, there's a lot of money to be made in that business. You ever think about why that is? You know what people have figured out in marketing and advertising is that if they can get an idea here and here and here and here, if they can get their product in front of you, if they can get you talking about it, if they can get you listening for it, if they can get you grabbing for it, then the money's going to come their way. One of the best ways, if you are in marketing, one of the best ways and you're trying to reach the most amount of people and get the most bang for your buck, you know, one of the best ways today in our culture to do this, although social media is changing this, but one of the best ways has always been a Super Bowl commercial. You know, because hands down, the most attention that you're ever going to get on TV is during the Super Bowl. If you want as many eyes of the world on your product or your idea as possible, take out a 30-second Super Bowl ad. You know how much it costs to do that? This last year, this just a few months ago, the 2024 Super Bowl, to take out a 30-second advertisement cost $7 million. Why in on the earth? I mean, if you make $100,000 and you want to reach the world, you know, $7 million, you work for 50 years, I don't know, I'd do the math on that. But yeah, you can do that and spend your whole life paying for it. Why do companies spend $7 million for 30 seconds? It's because they know that the eyes of the world are on that game. And they know if they can get their product in your face and they can get you thinking about it and get you talking about it and get you looking for it at the store, that money is going to be worth it for them. So that's what God is doing. This isn't modern stuff. Advertising and marketing, it's how God designed us to work. He knows that the things we put in front of us, the things that we talk about and the things that we listen to and read are the things that are going to end up here and here. And so that's how we learn to set our mind on things above. We take God's word, we take those things and we talk about them and we listen to them and we look at them and we write them down. That's the solution. Still isn't easy, though. And it still doesn't change the fact that we have to do all of that while living in a world that is below. My wife and I were having a conversation a few years ago about this, and she said it reminded her of a conversation she had with her mom when she was a little kid. And I just love this analogy, and it stuck with me ever since. She was riding in the car with her mom, and it was raining outside, and so her mom turned on the windshield wipers. And my wife, young girl at the time, had never remembered noticing the windshield wipers. You know, so imagine being a kid, you've never noticed that before, and all of a sudden you're sitting in the front seat, and you see these things start going back and forth right in front of you in your field of vision. And she was just like captivated by what was going on in front of her, but she was sort of confused by it, because in her mind, she'd never seen this before, and so that was all that she could focus on, was this motion in front of her constantly going back and forth. So she asked her mom, how in the world do you drive with these things going back and forth in front of you like that? Her mom thought about it for a second. She said, well, I guess you just learn to look through them. And she told me that story, and I thought, you know what, that's exactly right.
How do we learn to look at heavenly things when we live in a world where the earthly things, the things below, are right in front of us, making as much motion and as much noise as they can to get our attention? And I think that's it. We learn to look through them. We learn to look beyond them. Now, the answer to this is not that you ignore the rain. You know, you act like nothing's happening, and so you don't turn your windshield wipers on at all. But the answer is also not to get so focused on the windshield wipers that you can't see in front of you. And the same thing is true of our lives. The answer to setting our minds above is not to ignore. We can't ignore the things of this world. At the end of the day, they are realities that we have to live in and participate in. But we also can't go to the other extreme of being so distracted by them that we forget to look beyond. And so we learn to do that very thing. One other reason that we do this, Paul said in Colossians that we do it because we've died. John's answer to this is also helpful. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, "Do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life, is not from the Father, but is from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God lives forever." So Paul's answer is, you look at things above because you have died. You've passed away. John's answer is, you look at the things above because the things around you, everything in this world, it's passing away. It's not going to be around. Any of you recognize the picture on the screen behind me? I don't know if this person looks familiar to you or not. This is a picture of a man named Jim Elliot. Jim Elliot was born in 1927. He was a missionary who grew up in the U.S. and then at some point as a young man decided to go to South America to try to preach to indigenous tribes there in Ecuador. And most of his time there was spent working with the group of people called the Quechua, the natives of Ecuador. So he went down there as a young man, and shortly, I think, after he moved down there, he married a girl that he had met back in school. And then she moved down there after a short time, and they had a baby girl. And all this time, he still continued to reach out to the citizens of Ecuador, the Quechua people, learning the language, working with them. And he finds out over the course of time about this smaller group of the smaller tribe of people, kind of off in the remote parts of Ecuador, a group of people called the Warani tribe. And the Warani tribe was really remote, and they stayed that way because whenever anybody from the outside world would try to interact with them, they'd be violent with them. They'd forcibly keep that distance. In fact, the Quechua had another word. They called them the Aucas, and it was basically a Quechua word that meant savage. And yet, Jim Elliot was so troubled by this thought that there could be people on the planet that had never heard the name of Jesus, that he just thought, I got to find a way to go talk to him, to try, at least. And so he and his friends who were there in Ecuador, fellow missionaries, kind of came up with a plan, and what they decided to do is they started by flying over some of these Warani villages, and they would drop down supplies and goods just to kind of try to get them to see that they were there for good reasons. You know, they were trying to be helpful. And then eventually they set up a camp across a river from the main Warani village. So they lived there for a while and just waited to see what would happen. And eventually some of the Warani tribesmen came over to their camp. And so they would try to interact, and they would give them gifts and use, you know, kind of rudimentary sign language to show them, explain to them that they were there to be friendly and to be helpful. There was even an occasion where one of the tribesmen, they took him up in their airplane and gave him a ride in the airplane and showed him around and everything. And so that tribesman went away, went back home to his village, but he lied about them. And he told the village that they were there for other purposes. And so one day, there in the camp, Jim Elliot and his friends got a visit from a number of Warani tribesmen, and these were not the ones that had been there before. This was a group of warriors, I think maybe 10 of them. And they came into the camp of Jim Elliot and his friends, and they killed him. You know, here's a guy who's got a baby girl. And a wife, young wife, who's now a widow. Why would anybody do that? I think people like Jim Elliot did this because he was so troubled by the thought that somebody could not know Jesus that he was compelled to, no matter what it cost him. And let me be clear, I'm not trying to tell you that you have to move away to South America and be a missionary and, you know, go try to find people that are going to hunt you down with spears. But there's something about Jim Elliot that has stuck with me. There's a quote that's attributed to him from something that he wrote. And it wasn't at this time, it was earlier in his life. But here's what Jim Elliot said. And it kind of explained the way that he thought. He said, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain that which he cannot lose." And that's right. And as hard as that must have been for him to do what he did, knowing his wife, about his wife and his baby and the risk of that, I think what he also realized is that what God promised to his people is something that can't be taken away. So when you have the promise of something that can't be taken away, and you have a life full of stuff that can be taken away, is it really a risk to push that on the table and to face the possibility of losing that in exchange for something that can never be taken from you? And that's why we set our mind on things above. Is because at the end of the day, all this stuff that's around us that's so appealing and so tempting that can captivate our attention, at the end of the day, it's not something we can hang on to. It's something that we will always lose. But when we set our mind on things above, we lay up our treasures in heaven, and where our treasures are, there's our heart. There our heart will be also. And our heart will be in a place, our treasures will be in a place where they can't be taken from us. So, where's your heart this morning? Are you setting your mind on things above, or is the world crowding out those things so much that it's just hard to get your bearings? Jesus offers an invitation to all of us. And we offer that invitation to you this morning to set your mind on things above. To bring your life to Jesus and let Him be the Lord of your life. Let Him show you how to do that. And let Him show you how to take your focus off of things that are only going to let you down in life and replace that with a focus on things that will only build you up. If you want that this morning, it's yours for the taking. We offer it to you. Jesus invites you to respond to that. To become a Christian, to be baptized, to wash away your sins. That's what we want to do. We're going to sing a song. Come to the front and let us know. If you have another need that we can help with, please come up and let us know how we can help. And let's stand and sing together.